TSU-FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law and affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, as well this year as a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Thank you so much for joining me today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on my CIS colleague of sorts, Jonathan Mayer. Jonathan is a PhD candidate in computer science at Stanford University, where he got his JD in 2013. He is working on an article which is in draft form entitled Terms of Abuse, an Empirical Assessment of the Federal Hacking Law and How to Fix It. What he's referring to in this article is a topic that we have spent a little bit of time on Hearsay Culture, but never dedicated an entire show to. But I think, and I'd say unfortunately, given where we are, but fortunately because we have an expert, the time has come. The topic that he focuses on in his article is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which many listeners to Hearsay Culture will be familiar with. But for those of you that are not, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is a federal law designed to go after specifically unauthorized intrusions into computer networks. So you can think about the CFAA, and we'll use an acronym throughout the show, you can think about the CFAA as covering in its ideal setting that classic paradigm stereotype hacker, the person wearing the black trench coat and trying to break into networks without authorization and destroy the network, kill data, steal data, and the like. The CFAA, and Jonathan in his article goes through in really interesting detail the history of the legislation, which we'll talk about a bit, was designed really to go after those kinds of intrusions. However, as anyone who's dealt with not only law but bill drafting knows, the best laid plans often do not succeed, and the language of the CFAA is actually very ambiguous, and by that I mean unclear. Depending on your perspective, it either goes way too far or goes after all the people we should. Why am I saying that? One of the issues, and we'll get into the weeds of this a little bit on the show, is there's a question in the CFAA of what it means to have, quote, authorized access into a network. And when you think about that at a top level, you think, well, okay, authorization means that someone has given me permission to do whatever it is I'm doing. And at a superficial level, that makes sense. However, how authorization occurs, what authorization means, when authorization doesn't exist, and therefore what activity is ultimately unauthorized, is actually surprisingly not clear at all. Additionally, there are questions about what kinds of harms are necessary in order to establish liability under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And so, this federal hacking statute, as Jonathan identifies it in his article, was designed to be fairly straightforward, but it turns out has created enormous problems. The most high-profile problem or impact of the CFAA was the tragedy a few years ago involving the suicide of Aaron Swartz. And Aaron Swartz, as many listeners know, was a true genius who worked on a variety of important technological projects, but who was also involved with efforts to attempt to take data and articles in particular from online databases and release them to the public. And through that activity, he was charged with, among other things, prosecution under the CFAA for reasons which I am not familiar, and certainly I am not privy and would not begin to speculate, but ultimately Aaron Swartz wound up committing suicide, and part of the apparent motivation for that was concern that the prosecution or his own prosecution under the CFAA would cause untold hardship to him and his family. A true tragedy, and while I would not go so far as to say that the CFAA caused this, because I think that might be hyperbolic, I can certainly say that the law itself is problematic, and concerns about prosecution under the CFAA resonate heavily. So in Jonathan's article, which we will dive into a bit, and again, it is in draft form, he talks at length not only about the history of the CFAA, but the problems of the CFAA, and perhaps most interestingly, he gathers empirical data on criminal litigation under and civil litigation, for that matter, under the CFAA to draw some interesting conclusions. So, by way of background, Jonathan, again, is a PhD candidate in computer science at Stanford. He got his JD there in 2013. He was named one of the Forbes 30 Under 30 in 2014 for his work on technology, security, and privacy. He is a cybersecurity fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation, a junior affiliate scholar at CIS, where Hearsay Culture is run and where I'm an affiliate scholar. He's also a Stanford Interdisciplinary Graduate Fellow. He got his undergrad degree from Princeton at the Woodrow Wilson School, and he consults on a variety of these issues. He is joining us via Skype from his home office in San Francisco. We are recording the show on March 3rd, 2015. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Jonathan, let me start off with the standard question I ask all my guests virtually. Tell us a bit more about your background and how you came to focus on the CFAA.
Sure. So my background split between computer science and law. CFAA is one of the areas of law that neatly fits that that sort of dual academic upbringing. It necessarily involves some difficult legal decisions around what the statutory text means and how that aligns with some longstanding constitutional protections. And it also involves some difficult technical analysis around what sorts of conduct should be permissible and what should we consider more routine these days. So it seemed like a great place to split the difference. Certainly, computer security policy has gotten a lot of attention recently, and rightly so. Seemed worthwhile to try to understand whether the statute was working in the ways it seemed intended to work, or whether perhaps some of the criticisms of the statute hit the mark.
So let's start there, and I want to talk about the CFAA broadly, and then we can dig in a more granular way. So, right, many listeners to Hearsay Culture, as I mentioned, are familiar with cybersecurity issues and with the CFAA. But if you're talking to the neophyte, to the person that isn't familiar, let's start at that very top level question that any, I think, good interviewer would ask, which is why should the average and, let's say, technology user be interested in the CFAA as a statute?
So the easy answer is it sure seems like law should do something about hacking, and in particular, criminal law should do something about hacking. There are very serious intrusions that occur, causing lots of damage. Certainly, towards the end of last year, the Sony data breaches captured tremendous public imagination. There is a legitimate role for law to play on computer security, and CFAA for now is the leading federal law on computer security. Kind of the intended use of CFAA makes it worth studying. The unintended uses also make it worth studying.
And what are those unintended uses?
There are a number of ways in which there are a number of ways in which the statute has been invoked that have caused concern. One is use to go after folks who just violated the legalese on a website, the terms of service, terms of use, which even the Chief Justice, by the way, admits he doesn't read. For instance, in one high-profile case against Lori Drew, there was a prosecution where the theory was this person had violated the MySpace terms of use. The fact pattern was really ugly. It's not to say this person was innocent in the colloquial sense, but a hacker, not so much. If violating a terms of service, terms of use, is enough to put you on the hook, then all sorts of folks are criminals. One of my favorite examples dug up by some advocates over the Electronic Frontier Foundation was the website 17.com. At one point had a provision in their terms of service, if I'm recalling correctly, that said you promise you're over 17. So if you went to 17.com and you were actually 17 years old, you committed a federal crime, in theory. It's just exceedingly broad, and under certain interpretations of the statute, wouldn't just criminalize contractual breaches, could also criminalize breaches of agency duties, could also criminalize sort of objective misconduct, whatever courts decided that meant. So some exceedingly broad scope of liability, checked only by the requirement that there be a computer involved. And whatever limiting effect that might have had back in the 1980s, where CFAA is rooted, certainly these days saying, oh yeah, the fact pattern has to involve a computer, probably discounts roughly no fact patterns.
And so that, you know, you mentioned how one could, you know, in a very, somewhat humorous way, stumble upon liability under the CFAA. But you also mentioned some very purposeful activity, which is why I want to ask you to situate the CFAA broadly in information law, right? There's lots of law that certainly covers hacking. And as we know, particularly as we're recording this show on March 3rd, 2015, there are efforts right now underway, really led by the White House, to attempt to make cybersecurity standards higher and to make violations of policies involving networks and stealing information from networks more risky in terms of penalties. Where does the CFAA fit in this panoply of regulation dealing with use and misuse of computer networks?
So CFAA is rooted primarily in trespass law. The idea in roughly the 1970s, 1980s, was to borrow principles of physical trespass and use those for computer systems. And that may have had a certain logic at the time. Computers were largely single purpose. They largely weren't networked. Kind of had a very defined community of users, if they even had multiple users. And so this notion of trespassing on a computer was easier to apply, just because you would really know if you were using a computer you weren't supposed to use. For instance, some of the cases Congress looked at involved breaking into medical databases, breaking into NASA, where, you know, there's just, it doesn't matter how you define hacking, that's going to be culpable under the statute. So that's where the law came from and where it fit in as against conventional legal doctrines. But of course, these days computers are shared. Cloud computing involves using the same computing resources as millions, sometimes hundreds of millions, or in the case of Facebook, for instance, over a billion other users. So the lines around what's permissible and what's not have become incredibly blurry. And I think it's time to really earnestly reassess the extent to which there is room for a trespass-like cause of action within the law surrounding information technology. I think there's unambiguously a role for it, but I think it needs to be very, very carefully scoped.
And that's where I want to head shortly after the break. We're chatting with Jonathan Mayer of Stanford University on KZSU-FM at Stanford, discussing his draft article, Terms of Abuse, an Empirical Assessment of the Federal Hacking Law and How to Fix It. So this is really interesting, Jonathan. This is a good time to ask about it. So you're teaching a course at Stanford called Surveillance Law, and putting aside the title of it and the fact that I might want to enroll, which I guess perhaps I could at some level, how does – you can talk a bit about the course, which I think is interesting, but in addition, how does – or how might you frame the CFAA as a law of surveillance, if it is?
So for government purposes, CFAA doesn't really do a lot to regulate surveillance. The clearest reason for that is there's just a statutory exception for law enforcement and intelligence activity. Every so often, when there's news about some sort of government hacking, there will be some responses about, hey, doesn't this violate the federal hacking statute? For the most part, the answer is going to be unambiguously, nah. That conduct is regulated really by the Fourth Amendment and to a lesser extent by the Electronic Communications Privacy Act.
And so with regard to the surveillance law course, and that's kind of where I was headed, you've got these regulations like the CFAA that that theoretically govern private activity. But of course, you know, there is also, you know, this patina of government action also on the surveillance side. And so we've got these lines drawn in the law between what's permissible for the private sector to do and what's permissible for law enforcement and the government to do. Tell us about your surveillance course and how you deal with those kinds of issues, and just generally about the course itself.
Sure. So the backstory of the course is kind of fun. I taught the seminar at Stanford Law last spring. Candidly, I wasn't sure how I'd feel about teaching. The students were just spectacular. I really, really, really enjoyed it. And so this one of these large law casebook publishers approached me about doing a text on security and privacy law, since there's a lot of interest in the subject right now. Having recently been a law student and having loathed casebooks for the variety of reasons law students usually loathe them, I didn't have a lot of interest in that, but I still had a teaching requirement to take care of, and I had liked teaching. So I thought maybe I'd do one of these online course things. It wound up taking far longer to prepare the material than I thought, in part because animations, it turns out, are really, really difficult to put together in a way that clearly explained legal ideas. And in part because surveillance law really is not well synthesized. A lot of the work for the course wound up being almost research, looking at where the courts were, and in some cases just quantifying roughly two-thirds of district courts come out one way on an issue, one-third on another. So awful lot of work, very rewarding. I think we're at over 35,000 enrollments now.
Amazing.
Which is pretty remarkable. And so that's the backstory on the course. And one of the reasons why I like teaching that material is the same reason I like working on CFAA. It inherently splits computer science and law. To understand government surveillance practices thoroughly, you have to understand the technology government is using to surveil, in addition to the legal rules that surround the technology. And regrettably, a lot of the law that's arisen around surveillance is not very well informed about the technology. And a lot of the technical claims around surveillance are not super well informed about the law. So the hope with the course was to split the difference.
And so I want to ask you about that. As you mentioned it a few times, and it's a really interesting topic, which in sum is how lawyers and technologists speak to each other. Through CIS, through CITP, you've got centers that attempt, as you know, to merge your two interests. And yet there's also, from a policymaking perspective, still an enormous gulf between us lawyers, right, and you technologists, or you technologists and us lawyers. And so the question becomes this, and I'm curious, because you're one of those people in the middle, what do you see as the primary challenge to that communication? Is it simply that we're dealing with complex technology, and you either have that background or you don't, or is there something else or some other factors going on? Any thoughts on that?
I think there's a lot that contributes to it. One great issue is there's a lot of mistrust isn't quite the right word, but not enough recognition, I feel, among thought leaders on both sides that there is tremendous legitimacy in the other discipline, and there is a tremendous scope of content that's just outside their expertise, right? It's so common to hear some extraordinarily talented lawyer say, "I'm not a computer scientist, but," and then faceplant on some technical details. And likewise, hear some incredibly sharp computer scientists say, "I'm not a lawyer, but." And I guess I found it kind of challenging to get folks to set aside their preconceived notions of the other discipline and specific topics within the other discipline, and take a sort of tabula rasa approach. I didn't go to law school, or I'm not a technical researcher, and so I'm going to assume that the things you say about this are, you know, far, far more nuanced and correct than my own intuition about them. That sort of willingness is rare. There are some folks who are exceptional at it, kind of know when to hold them, know when to fold them, intellectually speaking. For the most part, I think there really needs to be a lot more willingness to trust the other field.
You know, the genesis of hearsay culture, which I founded when I was a fellow at CIS back in 2006, was precisely that I felt that different disciplines weren't talking to each other. And I wasn't thinking specifically of Stanford. I was thinking generally. And so that's been a goal of the show, which is why, and I am one of those people. I have a legal background, a legal training background, and a labor relations background. And here I am, right, as a fellow at the Center for Internet Society and working with people at CITP. So that need is there, and I think it plays directly and back into your article about the CFAA. A lot of the issues around how the CFAA was drafted, right, and versus what it was actually intended to do. So let's dive back into the CFAA, and I'll ask you this, and this is about as, you know, this is really a question about the nuts and bolts of the law. So I gave a brief overview of how the CFAA is written. I'm not asking you, of course, to read statutory language, but for those that aren't familiar, give us the basic structure of the CFAA.
So CFAA is a collection of various bases for liability that can be invoked both as criminal charges and as civil causes of action. That is to say, the government can try to throw you in the clink for a CFAA violation, or someone can sue you for money. Or an injunction for a CFAA violation. The best known bases of liability under CFAA are the ones that are a sort of computer trespass, and they're scoped around accessing a computer system or accessing information. So the million-dollar question is, was that access authorized? There are other bases of liability under the statute. For instance, part of the statute deals with intentionally damaging computer systems, either in the physical sense or with something like a denial of service attack. Another part of the statute deals with trafficking in passwords, and yet another deals with extortion. So there's a sort of broad range of offenses there. In my empirical work, it sure appears that litigation under CFAA is concentrated pretty highly under just a handful of the offenses, the ones about unauthorized access and getting information or committing fraud or intentionally damaging a computer system.
So with regard to the CFAA and how it's been used, and this is all really still framing your critique, this question of authorization becomes key. And so when we think about authorization of use of a computer system, what does that actually mean? Does it mean passwords? Does it mean contracts? Does it mean all of the above? How does a technologist think about authorization?
Let me start with the how the legal academy and the courts
fair enough. Go ahead.
Have thought about that, and then let me get to thinking about it as a matter of technology.
Okay.
So the scholarship on CFAA has historically roughly divided interpretations of authorized access into either two or three categories, either the broad versus the narrow interpretations of the statute. Or some courts, some scholars have sliced and diced a little more finely, saying there is this agency way of reading CFAA, this contract way, and this code-based restrictions way. I'm going to get to what each of those mean in a moment. I tried to be a little more careful about where the courts are and where scholars are. And by my count, as of working on this paper, there are ballpark seven competing interpretations of how to scope authorization under the statute. And at least six of those interpretations have been used in the courts. One of them is a creature of academic scholarship for now. There's tremendous difference of opinion in how to figure out whether someone was authorized to access a computer system or access some information within a computer system. And let me just give a quick rundown of what those are.
Yeah, sure.
The oldest has to do with this this free-floating notion of objective standards that, you know, folks know when they're doing something wrong with a computer, or under the totality of the circumstances, would one think access was authorized? And that was used in the old cases primarily, again, because the old cases weren't hard. The breaking into the medical record system, like, doesn't matter how you define the scope of authorization, you're on the hook. So that's the oldest way of interpreting authorization. There is also a line of jurisprudence that hitches CFAA to agency law. The Seventh Circuit's perhaps best known for doing that. So the idea is, if you do something that breaches your fiduciary duties to your employer, then you're acting without authorization or exceeding authorization, and you can be on the hook under CFAA. There's another view adopted by the First Circuit and the 11th Circuit, where breaching a contract can be a CFAA violation. That comes up with employee use agreements, and also can come up with website terms of service agreements. There's some disagreement within that bucket of CFAA cases about whether there even needs to be full contract formation, or just some sort of clear statement is sufficient. So maybe it's even contract light. A fourth way of interpreting authorized access is this interpretation popularized by the Ninth Circuit here in California, but starting to gain traction across the country, that tries to draw a line between restrictions on access and restrictions on use. And if that sounds super slippery, that's right, because it is super slippery. Courts have really struggled to figure out whether certain oral agreements, certain written documents constitute access restrictions or use restrictions. At least this much is certain. It's a view that's pretty hostile to broad uses of the statute. And courts have used it to narrow the statute a lot. The Fourth Circuit maybe adopted that view, maybe went a little bit further in a subsequent case. The Fifth Circuit suggested yet another view, which was you look at whether the way a person intended to use information was inherently criminal, and if it was, then access is without authorization. So it sort of scopes authorization to the criminal law writ large. And then, last but not least, perhaps the best known way of scoping authorization within legal scholarship is this idea of code-based restrictions, widely popularized by Orrin Kerr at GW Law, the idea being that circumvention of some sort of technical protection should be what determines the scope of CFAA liability. To my knowledge, no court has adopted that reading of CFAA. It has a logic to it, to be sure, but it's pretty difficult to reconcile with the statutory text and the legislative history, and several courts have explicitly rejected it. So I think that's kind of squarely in the realm of a legal academic approach to how the statute could be reformed, at least for now. And I guess I have my own reservations about the code-based view as a computer scientist. Mm-hmm. So now just pivoting into the how as a technical guy, I think about the scope of authorization.
Right.
It's not clear to me that there is really any consistently defensible way of scoping authorization that, you know, will give clear guidance to courts, that will give clear guidance to potential defendants. And that's because we use computer systems in all sorts of ways, all sorts of unintended ways these days. And I can say things like, that thing the defendant did was more technically difficult, or caused more harm, or or perhaps was a little more subtle, or required more time to do. So you can kind of list out various ingredients that might make some conduct more or less culpable. But it's at the end just going to be some mishmash standard. Even the idea of a code-based restriction, I mean, I think that's a great example of, for want of a better phrase, lawyers practicing computer science without a license. There is no notion in computer science of a bright-line code-based restriction on data. This is not how computer security researchers and practitioners talk about security. They talk about threats and attack surfaces and potential risks, but you know, they don't say at some point that was secure or that wasn't secure.
And this is where, and we'll take a break here and say you're listening to KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know it's on KZSU-FM Stanford, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu or go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. So Jonathan, that disconnect again, perhaps it's a theme of the show, but it's one that seems to be codified in the law. And you alluded to, and I alluded to, and now we should get into it, that legislative history. So you talk in great detail in the draft that I've read about that history and how we have the CFAA today. And perhaps I'll ask you to tailor it a bit by saying, you know, how is it that we get to the point today where we have these you know, massive ambiguities and dragnet potentials in the CFAA based upon the legislative history, before the follow-up question, which is we can talk about some of the criticisms or the primary criticisms that exist. What does that legislative history of the CFAA teach us about where we stand with this hacking law?
So the statute came out of this milieu in the late 70s, early 80s, where America was just totally taken by this stereotype of young hackers, these dangerous individuals, really, really smart, who could wreak all sorts of havoc on new technology. The movie War Games certainly did very well in theaters, a number of national publications featured young hackers on their front pages. Congress heard from a high school senior who talked about some of the computer intrusions he'd perpetrated. So
incredible.
So there was tremendous interest in the issue, not dissimilar to today, in fact. And in fact, Congress had a screening of War Games to try to understand how hacking worked. Now, I thought Matthew Broderick gave just a stunning performance. I mean, hats off to him. That was sarcasm.
I was about to say. So, you know, would you have preferred him as a witness or the teenager, respectfully, who had actually testified?
So I think. Neither. It would have been delightful if there had been a little greater foresight about how technology might evolve and what some of the risks were associated with passing a potentially broad hacking statute. The sort of cynical read on CFAA's history is that this was a very popular issue. There weren't really constituencies that might oppose legislative action on it. And so it was an opportunity for some members of Congress to look very forward on technology without a lot of downside. Whatever the case of the motivation behind it, this much can be said about CFA. Originally, it was a much narrower statute. It had fewer offenses. It was focused on specific sensitive areas of information or sensitive computer systems, financial information, for instance, classified government information. And so a lot of the issues we have today weren't quite there at the outset. But unfortunately, so there's this framework put together in 1984 and then overhauled in 1986 that set up this notion of computer trespass. And then over the intervening decades, the statute just creeped up, kind of got broader and broader. The penalties got more and more draconian. I think one easy way of understanding the statute is just to track what the broadest provision used to be
right.
and what it is now.
Okay, very good.
So the broadest provision back when CFA was enacted had to do with taking financial information. These days, the broadest provision relates to taking any information from any computer system, including those outside the United States, without authorization or exceeding authorization. So kind of the remaining scoping elements about sensitive computer systems, sensitive information, really have fallen by the wayside.
So Jonathan, as we sit here today and we're getting close to what I call the unfair portion of the show. We have about 17 minutes left, and I started asking questions that you don't have time to answer adequately, but then I ask them anyway. One of the interesting harms here, it's particularly interesting given that that notation that you mentioned with regard to political opposition to the CFAA, because I think we're seeing the same issue arise in terms of a perception of lack of opposition in federalization of trade secret law, which also, you know, has a heavy cybersecurity patina to it. With regard to these different harms, one that you talk about in the article and I think is really interesting is the impact of the CFAA on security researchers themselves, right? The people who are out there who are technologists, who are computer science experts, who attempt to figure out how to exploit systems and then how to create better security systems. How does the CFAA impact the ability of researchers, and by that I do mean also academics, to do their job?
It unambiguously makes our jobs harder. So when not blathering about law, I also do some security research. I personally have had to call off a handful of projects for fear of CFAA liability concerns. I've certainly had colleagues at Stanford and elsewhere who have also had to call off what seemed very promising, very societally beneficial research out of CFAA concerns. And it's no hypothetical that a person might be sued, might be prosecuted. One case in Massachusetts comes to mind. So there were some MIT undergrads who discovered some security flaws in the MBTA payment system for taking the public transportation around Boston. And they wanted to present what they'd found at a conference. And the MBTA sued and actually got an injunction preventing the students from presenting their research. So no hypothetical there. Sony used CFAA, among other causes of action, to sue someone who reverse engineered parts of PlayStation 3 security. The idea there being, even if you own some device, you know, it's in your own home or in your own lab, well, you're licensing parts of it from the company. And so the company retains sufficient stake that you're actually hacking those components and they can sue over it. A really high-profile case that went up to a court of appeals involved a really offensive individual who exposed a vulnerability in AT&T's iPad registration system. It was one of those unfortunate cases where the defendant was not sympathetic very much. But that said, you know, he had found a vulnerability and called attention to it, perhaps in not the most responsible of ways, but in a at least legally pretty indistinguishable way from what security researchers in academia and in business do. So I think the chilling effects are very real. The litigation is not hypothetical. There is, thankfully, a lot less litigation than there might be. But regrettably, deterrence works, right? You know, you criminalize this stuff, and the good guys who would do the sorts of security research you would want, they're going to get deterred. They'll recognize the liability, and they'll be chilled in their research, and they are. Meanwhile, as a good friend who practices in this space pointed out, probably fair to assume the North Koreans aren't freaking out about CFAA penalties.
Right, right. And that's where, of course, you know, that's where the policy discussions lie so much when it comes to, at least today, cybersecurity issues. Let me ask you, Jonathan, before we talk about the empirical data and then what you would want to do in terms of fixing the CFAA and where you'd situate it, as you mentioned in the beginning, let me ask you this pushback question, because, you know, from the perspective of network owners, presumably there must be some reasons why, and I'm going to assume this, that they would not want you security researchers messing around with their networks, right? So in other words, if there were social benefits associated with your research, logic might dictate that this should not be prosecuted. In other words, right, that the CFAA, while it's on the books, right, the owners of those networks, the operators of those networks, would decline to pursue, right, you or anyone else under the CFAA, and prosecutors might do the same. So the pushback question is really this. To the extent that a network owner would be able to, on a principled basis, object to the kinds of security research that the CFAA creates liability for, what would their arguments be? What would they look like?
Well, so there's no doubt that security research is not always met with open arms. And I can't recall a time where I've called up a company and said, hey, I found this thing. And their response was, gee, thanks, we look forward to hearing more about it, and we recognize it was a real mistake, and there should be attention called to it, and we'll take our lumps. Mm-hmm. The conversation never goes like that. So, I think there is definitely not tremendous interest in having outsiders poke around software for a lot of businesses. There are some businesses that are more responsible, very roughly speaking, in the IT space, as opposed to companies that have a more traditional line of business and then happen to have some IT infrastructure associated with that business. Google, Facebook, those sorts of companies, not only do they tolerate folks poking around their systems, they'll actually pay you these so-called bug bounties. If you find something and report it, and it helps them close up a security flaw. So there's this tremendous disconnect. We've got this law in the books that is intended to cover that conduct, hacking conduct, regardless of motive. And we've got some companies saying, we will pay you if you successfully hack us and then tell us about it. So definitely time for a rethink, and certainly a rethink that won't have all businesses lining up on the same side of the issue.
So we're chatting with Jonathan Mayer, PhD candidate in computer science at Stanford University, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, Jonathan, now we are definitely into the unfair portion of the show. So let me ask you this question as we jump ahead. You collate and analyze empirical data with regard to CFAA prosecutions as well as civil actions. What does that empirical data teach us?
So I put together longitudinal data off of Westlaw and some resources that compile criminal data, and then also pulled down all of the complaints and criminal charging documents I could find under CFAA for 2012. All in, reviewed tens of thousands of pages. It was if I could do it all over again, I probably would have tried to find a way to narrow the scope of the study some.
That said, it took some time.
It definitely was a tremendous volume to sort through. But that said, I think the results, I hope, will be very valuable to the courts, to practitioners, and certainly to legislators thinking about what to do in this space. The results are pretty lopsided. In civil practice, the overwhelming majority of CFAA cases look nothing like hacking. They're largely commercial disputes between competitors or between a business and some former employee who took some data, and certainly not the Matthew Broderick-esque hackers. On the criminal side, it's a little closer in the breakdown of case compositions. Very roughly half of cases are the sorts of hackers that Congress emphasized. And the data does suggest that prosecutors have exercised some discretion. The data doesn't tell a story of prosecutors run amok. But at the same time, the data certainly tells a story of a law that is exceedingly broad and a caseload composition that really just can't be squared with the sorts of cases Congress seemed to really have in mind.
Now, Jonathan, this is a good time to ask you about this. And we have a few minutes left here, about 7 minutes. So quickly, Stanford hosted an event a short while ago dealing with cybersecurity issues, and there have been other political discussions. I know you've attended and been involved in some of this. What's your sense of not only that event, but really where policymakers' heads are with regard to these concerns?
I fear there's a little bit of a moment now, like there was in the 1970s and 80s, where there is tremendous agreement that something has to be done, that we've got this big computer security problem, and government needs to do something to address it. And I don't think that's wrong, but there's the risk that now, like in the 1980s, whatever's enacted isn't sufficiently future-proof. And there's also a risk that whatever's enacted doesn't necessarily make security better and potentially makes privacy worse. So let me give you a great example of a legislation that sounds good, but probably not. At least I wouldn't support it without some substantial changes. The White House has announced this data breach notification proposal, the idea being a number of states, I believe 47 by last count, have a data breach notification law on the books. And that sort of hodgepodge of competing state laws doesn't make so much sense. So let's have a federal standard for data breach notification. I think that unambiguously makes good sense. The problem is the specific federal standard that's proposed in this latest White House pitch is less rigorous than some states already have on the books. It doesn't require notification of as many breaches. It gives businesses more time to notify. And it doesn't require companies to pay for credit monitoring. And perhaps most importantly, it preempts state laws that already are more rigorous in all of those ways, including here in California. Sounds good, understand the desire to do something on the issue, but it sure doesn't seem like progress. It actually seems like the opposite of that, as proposed. Regrettably, I think the same is true of many of the administration's recent proposals, including those associated with the Stanford event.
And I know time is short here for you, and so we have about 3 minutes left. Let me ask you this follow-up question. Whenever I have broached the topic of fixing the CFAA, and admittedly I haven't done a lot of that, but when I have talked to Senate staffers and when I've talked to other people involved on the advocacy side in Washington, I literally get laughed at. The response is, no way we're touching the CFAA. We can't do it. We won't do it, and on and on. And so what's your sense of put aside for the moment how you might reform it, which you can certainly work into an answer, but what's your sense of the willingness of Congress to even touch the CFAA? And perhaps you could talk a little bit about why it is that it seems to be, as to quote the late Senator Paul Tsongas, right, a third rail of American politics.
That's certainly the same as my experience in discussions about reforming the statute. One reason for that is there isn't enough political oomph to get the statute reformed. Right? So, you know, who would be the constituent saying, we really need to fix this law? Security researchers, traditionally not a strong lobby in Washington.
Right.
And the sort of rest of folks who might be impacted by liability are very scattershot. So kind of not a clear lobby on the pro side. And then there are some clear lobbies on the con side. In addition to the Department of Justice, which certainly wants to preserve a broader CFAA and certainly has a strong voice in the legislative process, there are a handful of companies that have made it known that they would like to keep CFAA broad. Perhaps not making it known most publicly, but certainly on the Hill. Oracle, for instance, is quite fond of using CFAA to bop competitors. So it has this business model where it sells aftermarket service for its database systems. And it likes to use CFAA to bop competitors that try to download Oracle software and repackage this aftermarket service. It wouldn't be able to do that under a narrower CFAA, so doesn't want to see CFAA narrowed. So there's one example of a technology company that just very clearly behind the scenes is saying, nah, we don't support narrowing the statute, and we would oppose narrowing the statute. So I think that's kind of the core political dynamic. Combine that with no one wants to be weak on computer security. No one wants to look like they're making the situation worse given what's in the news. And combine that with there's all sorts of other stuff on the legislative docket. Regrettably, I don't see a lot of movement from Congress on this issue anytime soon.
And so
maybe the courts.
And that's what I was wondering. I was going to ask you that, but I know that we have about 1 minute left that I know you have to run. So let me ask you this question in 60 seconds. Unfair question. So if you have your druthers and you can fix the CFAA, what is your proposal? What do you want Congress to do?
I would narrow it substantially. In the data set I compiled, the cases involving serious offenders, the recognizable names, Lulzsec and Anonymous and so on, those just weren't close cases. It would be possible to sharply narrow CFAA even beyond requiring some sort of circumvention of a technical protection, however defined. Perhaps include some mental state elements around intents to harm or intents to financially gain. Really use all the tools at the legal system's disposal to rein in the statute. I think there unambiguously, again, is a role for something like CFAA. Some folks have said it's time to just knock CFAA off the books. I think that's not right. And in fact, in the cases I looked at, prosecutors weren't charging other offenses in CFAA cases, lending some support to the view that CFAA is kind of a unique remedy. Or at least the strongest remedy currently available. So I think there is definitely a role for a statute like CFAA, but just a much narrower statute.
Jonathan Mayer, PhD candidate at Stanford University, and author of the draft article, Terms of Abuse, an empirical assessment of the federal hacking law and how to fix it, an article which at some point in the hopefully near future we will see in print. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. You know, these issues involving hacking laws obviously are not going away. They're only gaining in importance. So thank you for what is at least a draft I've seen, a really terrific piece of work that should inform policymakers as well as scholars. Thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thanks again for having me.
So with the remaining time we have on Hearsay Culture schedule for this quarter, we have a number of interesting guests coming up. Among those guests, and next week, Jack Rabid, editor-in-chief and founder of the legendary music magazine The Big Takeover. On March 18th, Pedro Rafi of the International Center for Trade and Sustainable Development and Professor Javi Soiba of the University of Strasbourg, co-authors of ACTA and the Plurilateral Enforcement Agenda, and hopefully rounding out this quarter, Professor Biela Coleman of McGill University, author of Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture this quarter. You can listen at noon Pacific time on KZSU Stanford on Wednesdays by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu or by listening through the radio in the Bay Area. You can also get the show via podcast by going to the Center for Internet Society's page in iTunes or by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And also, you can get the show by going to the webpage for Hearsay Culture at hearsayculture.com. I'm excited to mention, and I'll say something more officially down the road, but I am in the process with some wonderful volunteers in redesigning the Hearsay Culture website, and so I'll talk more about that as the day approaches, but I've already seen some mock-ups, and I'm very excited about how the page will look, and I will do more formal thanks and announcements as we get closer. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by going to dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.